today's podcast, we dig into Magic's role with the Lakers, other than just torching them on television, and what the offseason could look like. Mikal Bridges from the best team in the NBA, one of the stars of the Phoenix Suns. WeWork's The Story, We Crashed is a television show on Apple, and the co-creators Lee Eisenberg and Drew Crivello join us, and we've got a really weird life advice. It's the Ryan Russillo podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sports book. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same-game parlays for every NBA game. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available. And listen to the end of the episode for additional details. Must be 21 and older and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Netflix. Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Seven-time world champion and modern-day legend Tom Brady, the greatest of all time, finally gets roasted. Hosted by Kevin Hart, Tom Brady gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night when everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix. I want to start with a tradition unlike any other, and that's television stations calling Magic Johnson saying, hey, do you want to pour some jet fuel on the fucking Lakers? And he's like, yep. How many shows can I do? So let's run through some of this Lakers stuff, which is going to be news, and it's going to continue to be news throughout the playoffs, the draft, free agency. It's just not going away. So why don't I jump in as well? So Magic goes on a bunch of the ESPN shows, and his basic goal is one thing. When things go wrong with the Lakers, he wants Lakers fans to know that he would have done it differently and that none of this is on him. And in a weird way, I guess it isn't. But at the same time, he's still advising the team all the time. It's a very different role. And I just think it's odd in general. Like, we're so numb to it because he's been doing it for such a long time. And yeah, he's got a big ego. If I were Magic Johnson in LA, guess what? I'd have a massive ego too. If there's somebody that's allowed to have a big ego, I think Magic Johnson is okay to do it. But that's also what drives a lot of this stuff. It's just very odd. And I could think of like a comp that doesn't make any sense because it'd be impossible to imagine it. But imagine if Larry Bird lived in the Boston area and every 6 months would go on ESPN and be like, I don't know why they took Romeo Langford. Guy sucks. Like, yeah, I don't know about this trade. Derek White, give up another first back-to-back years if the Celtics weren't playing well. Like, that would just be so weird. But we're just so used to it with Magic. We're like, oh, wait, he's doing this again? And he did it. And he did it big time. And he actually got a lot of stuff wrong. So he said that he got a call from DeMar DeRozan's agent, that he would have brought in DeMar DeRozan. He would have done that deal with the Lakers, would have brought him home. He wanted to come home. But it was LeBron's fault because Westbrook's there, which it is LeBron's fault that Westbrook is with the Lakers. So part of this is that Magic's telling you that he gets the call from the agent, as if the agent, an NBA agent who has a client like DeMar DeRozan, doesn't have a cell phone number for anyone that makes decisions with the Lakers. But that's also part of the sell job here, too. First of all, we know the Lakers had no cap space. The most they could offer DeRozan was $5.9 million, which was the taxpayer's mid-level, which was not going to happen because DeRozan was going to get over $20 million. And by the way, he ended up signing over a three-year deal with the Bulls, $82 million to $85 million with some of the bonuses or incentives. So that wasn't going to work, right? I'm just throwing it out there so that we understand. And by the way, with DeRozan, let's not have, because he's been awesome this year. Most of us thought that deal didn't make any sense. 3 years, $82 million for someone that much older. Not many of us like that deal. So now everybody's going back being like, oh, we should have brought in DeRozan. And by the way, there's still years left on the deal. It's kind of that weird thing that'll happen in baseball sometimes where a guy gets like a six-year deal that all of us think is terrible and he goes 3-for-4 on opening day. People are like, well, thought this was a bad deal. And you're like, you know, we got like 6 years to go on this one, guys. Let's see how it goes. But so far, DeRozan has proven everybody wrong. And the sign and trade that the Bulls made with San Antonio wasn't exactly like a war chest of assets. It was Thaddeus Young, a first, couple seconds. So maybe the Lakers could have done that. Not impossible, certainly, if they wanted to include Kuzma in some kind of deal. But then we've got to ask ourselves, do the Spurs want Kuzma? Kuzma's money isn't crazy. As soon as he signed his contract, you're like, actually, you're going to get traded now because it's a very tradable contract. Kuzma on his best days is a really good player. On his worst days, you're not quite sure how he fits in. So maybe San Antonio would have done some sort of sign and trade with DeRozan. The picks part of this is pretty light, though, for the Lakers because we understand all the picks they included in the Anthony Davis deal. So let's say that's a possibility. The part where Magic continues on, He was like, yeah, but I also would have done the Buddy Hield deal. We're like, well, who the fuck were you trading for Buddy Hield if you were doing a sign and trade with DeRozan? And then he said he would have kept Caruso and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. You're like, well, wait, you can't do these things. At that point, they'd been hard capped with the AD and LeBron deals, and then just sort of magically keeping everybody and some DeRozan extension that would have been in the 20s. So none of that made any sense. And he had no problem just saying all the stuff that would have happened. But this isn't new. This isn't new. And if I'm a Lakers fan, I wonder if you go, I think he thinks that people will go, and maybe a lot of Lakers fans do. They're like, yeah, he's right. We could have had DeRozan. Like, do you see what Magic said? Man, we screwed this up. It's too bad Magic isn't in charge again. And you're like, yeah, but the guy that just said he would have done all these things, like, I think he just was talking. You know, I don't know that it's that he doesn't understand what some of the rules are. That seems to be a little aggressive, but I don't know. Like, I checked with a cap guy, too. I'm like, wait, none of this makes any sense. He's like, collectively, no, it doesn't. It doesn't make any sense. And to add to the Magic conversation, this, do you remember what he was saying when the Lakers did get Russell Westbrook? Let's go over some of the tweets. Laker Nation, a blockbuster trade that's bringing Russell Westbrook to the Lakers is very exciting. It will definitely make the Lakers a championship contender next season. With Westbrook joining LeBron and AD, the Lakers now have their version of the big three. All we need now is a couple shooters would be tough to beat. Actually, I'll agree with that part of it. Also in July of last year, Russell Westbrook is the most electric player in the NBA today, and Staples Center will be on fire next season. Well, on fire may actually be correct for a different reason. Let's look at the rest of the roster, at least the pieces that we can talk about here. Anthony Davis trades. I still like Anthony Davis. I feel like less and less people agree with me on that one. If you want to say that he's inconsistent, he's hurt all the time, he's soft, he doesn't quite have that alpha edge, I'll agree with you on all those things. But the best case scenario for the Lakers is to get Anthony Davis back, which I don't think at his age is impossible if he figures out the right training regimen. Or maybe he'll be hurt the rest of his days, and it'll be a huge disappointment and a career unfulfilled and all of those things, all right? LeBron doesn't win a title without him, and we know that AD didn't do anything down in New Orleans without a guy like LeBron, all right? So they needed each other. Everybody needs somebody in the NBA. But if you're thinking of Anthony Davis trades, it's a little bit more complicated because of the LeBron factor, right? You can't just trade Anthony Davis for picks to recoup some of the picks you sent to New Orleans or young players coming back. LeBron's not interested in any of those things. He's not. So that limits kind of what you're able to do. There's one very consistent rule that can be broken at times, but it's fairly consistent in the NBA that teams, when they have established players, do not like to trade their established players for other established players that may be dealing with some sort of problem. When Paul George was available to everyone, the Pacers back then, when he wanted out of Indiana, they called everyone in the league. I talked to multiple teams about it, and they were like, yeah, you know, Paul George being offered everybody here because they know that they're screwed, and he's telling everybody he's out of there, that he wants to play for the Lakers, and, you know, it's not going to happen. And a couple of trades that I heard about, I remember talking to one team in particular where I was like, well, Paul George is better than the guys that you'd be sending out. And they go, yeah, but here's the thing is we're adding Paul George to our crew that's already established. We are not trading our non-problems that are established for a new problem that isn't established with us. And who knows what Paul George is going to do, because that guy changed his mind like three or four times within a few months. Let's be fair, maybe a year and a half, right? So if you're saying Anthony Davis isn't healthy, LeBron wants to do something else, where's the trade where you're trading him for established pieces that are coming back so the other team is restarting what they're doing with somebody that has injury concerns? So yes, there could be a third team where the picks go to the other team, Davis goes to one, and then some established guys go somewhere else. But those trades kind of don't really happen that much. Again, not impossible. Impossible is not a word that we like to use in the NBA when we talk about trades, and that segues perfectly into Russell Westbrook. Because at $47 million in 1 year left, there's some stuff you could do. But it's really difficult because you're probably adding an asset on top of everything else to send Russell Westbrook out. So what do you have that's ready to compete and who's established that exists that a team is willing to trade? Now, I think LeBron and the crew wanted to do the John Wall deal because they felt like just getting Westbrook out of here is an improvement. And I would agree with that part, but again, it's still their fault he was there in the first place. But that's the other problem with the Westbrook trade is it's not just that you're trading this guy with an incredible individual resume, right? You're trading somebody who looks in the mirror and still sees a superstar. And his stubbornness is what has made him such a productive player who will one day be in the Hall of Fame. But if you have a young team, and Orlando always gets brought up all the time, right? Like, think of the stale teams. Hell, we could even throw Houston back in this. OKC would be part of this too, because some people wonder, like, would Presti, if you threw in a pick in 2027, would he be willing to do this, Would he figure out some way like, hey, bring Westbrook back? Westbrook with a bunch of young players as you're actually like on year two or three of your rebuild doesn't make a lot of sense either. To have all of your young players that are lottery picks watching him run up and down the court and chuck it up 20 times, is that really what a lot of teams will want that feel like, yeah, we might not be any good, but do we want to disrupt whatever development we hope to build here with somebody like Westbrook? So that complicates that as well. It's going to get weird, all right? And LeBron has already hinted at some of this stuff where he said on the shop he wanted to play with Steph Curry. He said that he wanted to play with Luka. This is, I imagine, some version of him presenting leverage to the Lakers because LeBron has consistently done this at every stop. He wants to put pressure on ownership and management. He doesn't think that anybody will ever act to the limits of their abilities, right? To the absolute ceiling, pushing it, being like, we need to win, we need to win. And I disagree with this, by the way. I think teams all want to win. But he feels like unless there is a threat of him deciding to do something, that teams never, the owners will not be as all in unless they feel threatened. And that's why he hinted at the Steph stuff, which, you know, I didn't make a ton of sense. The Doncic part, it's like, wait, do I want to bring this guy in? I know Windhorst had a thing about the Clippers. Look, when LeBron tried to recruit Kawhi to come as a free agent, Kawhi wasn't really vibing with LeBron whatsoever and didn't want to go with him and decided to do his own thing. And the other thing, when you start talking about certain players that you build around and say, okay, I'm going to dump all of these draft picks in the future because I want to bring in players now to support our current guy. If LeBron's in his early 30s, you can kind of understand that. But even with LeBron, there's some kind of risk. You know, there's a version of this Clippers thing, which I completely understand, and everybody would do, getting Kawhi and Paul George. But down the road, they may look at this going, look at these unprotected picks and what a disaster this ended up being. That could happen to them. When you look at Milwaukee trading for Jrue Holiday, that one makes a little bit more sense because I think you get the feeling that Giannis is a more content player. And that's also another weird topic that's entirely different. But we have a lot of the American players that seem to get really unhappy very quickly, where it feels like some of the foreign players are better bets to build around because you feel like there's less of a threat of them deciding they want to bounce. I mean, look at the names and look at the history of the players of the last decade that have forced their way out. A lot of the foreign guys seem to be a lot more happier about it. So I don't even know what that means. But there's a summary on all of this, right, with LeBron James, and it's simple. As you get a little bit older, and he's going to make a push here for the scoring title, and he sat out games. I'm a little surprised by this because he's going to end up getting crushed by it. And I think a lot of times that they calculate their moves, they try to do things that gets him the least amount of criticism. And in a way, him sitting out games where they were still eligible for the play-in, but now eliminated, and now he's going to push for the scoring title, which is now behind Embiid as Embiid's continue to be on this tear for the MVP. He's going to end up getting crushed for this stuff if he's playing specifically in loading up and trying to get points at the end of the season. Like, he's going to get crushed, but maybe he's only going to get crushed by the people that were already crushing him. But it's a lot like a relationship. And unfortunately, with LeBron and the Lakers, this is getting towards the end of the relationship. We're in the beginning of a relationship. All the weird stuff is still kind of cute because you're so excited. But at the end of it, you get sick of it really quickly. And that's going to be the standoff between player and franchise.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
Mikal Bridges of the Phoenix Suns joins us. This podcast has been very pro-Suns. I've always been a longtime Chris Paul fan. I think your team is terrific. We know the numbers, the clutch numbers and all the stuff, the one seed, the record, all of it. You were in the finals last year. How good is this year's team compared to last year?
Even better. And I remember kind of saying that preseason and kind of beginning of the season, I'm just looking around. I'm just like, all right, just the vibe and just people getting better and adding more people. I was just like, all right, this team got better than last year. And it's crazy to say that because we were really good last year. So, but now, especially like getting Craig back for a deadline and Aaron and stuff like that is just, it's crazy how we're a better team than we were last year. We were pretty damn good.
Yeah, you are. You are that. Was there a goal to play all 82 games for you this year? Because you're on pace for it, right?
Yes. I mean, that's a goal every year. It's goal, whatever season I'm in, wherever I'm at, just to play every game. I think that's just normal, just to play and be available. And, you know, obviously injuries is part of the game, but if I feel like I'm fine enough to play, I'll play.
Were you like, hey, how come everybody got to sit against the Clippers except for me? After you, everybody played against the Lakers.
No. I was coaching them. Just, you know, obviously, knowing the streak is alive. Just let me play. If I'm not injured, I don't see why I wouldn't play. But obviously, minutes is low. But I appreciate coaching staff and them just keep me out there.
AD had said some stuff about, hey, if we weren't hurt, no team wants to hear that on the other side. And you guys were really good last year, so we're not sure what would have happened. Was there a extra motivation maybe to have everybody play in the Lakers game and then sit against the Clippers?
I think everybody got their own added motivation, I guess, when we play them or any other team. But no, I mean, that's just, you say that about everything. It's just life, you know, just injuries. That was a part of the game. You just go back to every year, play all championships and stuff when people go down, and you never know what could have happened with things with that. So it is just part of the game. And he knows that, but I mean, I don't blame him for saying that. I feel like if it was a situation like that here, and I feel like a couple of my key players on the team went down, and you know, we didn't have them for a whole year, I feel like I would probably say the same thing.
What clicked for you? Was there a moment where, you know, you get in the league, you're a lottery pick, and you're finding your way? It's clear right away, like, okay, this guy's gonna have a long career. But was there a moment in your career, was the specific stretch of games during a season where you're like, okay, you know what, I'm actually gonna be good, like this is gonna work out?
I think my rookie year had a stretch where I was playing pretty well, maybe like a little road trip game where I was just like constantly scoring a good amount. I think defense, I'm always mindful about defense every time I'm out there. So that's not really stress. It's just trying to, especially when rookie, try to find shots and make shots and stuff like that. And I think there's a little stretch when I was on a roll. I think we played like San Antonio, Toronto. And yeah, I think it was a couple of them games. And actually, the Toronto game, I got Siakam gave me a game winner too. So I always remember that. That just ruined all scoring I had that day. It was just defeated because I gave up a game winner. So I think there was a little stretch there where I was scoring a little bit. It kind of, you know, made me felt pretty good.
And the defense has always been there too. Draymond Green said recently he thinks you should be Defensive Player of the Year. What was your reaction to that?
Just being a big fan of Draymond, and getting to know him a little bit more now and being cool with him is dope. But it's just funny how people will always go against him because of his knowledge and they don't think the game like him. And I just remember tweeting something during the USA where I think he had a shot or whatever, the drove, and it created for KD for a three. And I remember, I think maybe some social media account posted it and was trying to clown Draymond for not taking open shot or whatever. And I'm just like, how can you even say something like this when you just watch the old clip and everything he did led to Kevin Durant shooting a wide open three, catch and shoot three. So I'm just like, I don't know how you're going to clown a person for his IQ. So I've always been a fan, and I feel like that's just, you know, he knows. I mean, he does it all. You know what I'm saying? I'm actually, he's part of it for even, for me being in this convo for how many games he missed. So he's kind of helped me, you know, be up there in the race because he's really not eligible right now. So, but it's just, I mean, it's dope for him to say that, man. Definitely means a lot.
I was in prep for this. I was like, okay, I want to look at some of the defensive stuff specific. So I was watching all your Doncic matchups in the most recent game that you played against them. I think it was the most recent one. And, you know, he's your primary assignment when you play them, but obviously you're going to get switched off of a million times. Is that accurate? Like when you're lining up and saying, who do you got? Like Doncic is yours, but they're going to run so many high pick and rolls with him. Like you kind of have to figure out how many times you're going to be able to stay with him and how you're going to get switched off of a bunch, correct?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. What do you do when it's somebody like Doncic, knowing that, okay, I'm going to get screened all night? And what I do love about you, and I've always noticed this, and maybe you'd agree with me, I'm shocked how many defenders lose their man still, even at the NBA level. I know you play a million games. Guys can have some lazy habits.
Yeah.
You are constantly, when you get switched off of him, you still always kind of keep yourself, you know, man, you ball, that kind of stuff where you're like, all right, I still not going to lose track. And I still have to maybe help back to Doncic, even though I get switched off of him. What do you kind of run through your checklist of, okay, these are all the things that I have to remind myself being matched up against somebody like that?
That's what makes it so tough. Just guys like that, like Luka and them, just you got to always be aware of them on the court. And I don't think it's – obviously, I want to guard him and be the guy, but, you know, at the same time, just how we are as a team and, you know, we're trying to win. And I know he's the key player. He's ahead of the snake. And just team defense is knowing, like, all right, even if I switch off of him, I want to be guarding him, but I just got to always keep an eye because at the end of the shot clock or something like that, it's going to come back to him, and he's going to make the play. And I just, you know, rather have somebody else, you know, make that play rather than him just because how really good he is. And it's just all team defense, man. Just our knowing what we have to do and just our coaching staff helping with the scouts and kind of us as players thinking the game and knowing who what guys would rather shoot, you know, at the end of the clock than not.
He got you in the post, which, and I'm not saying like as a criticism, it's Luka, the size, and you got him a couple times. It looked like he wanted to go right back at you. Did he say something to you? Because he always thinks he's fouled, which we both know. But when he finished, did he say something to you after he finished you, after you had stopped him the previous time?
No, not that I know of. I think he probably was hyped up. I think I remember what you're talking about, but I mean, that's just part of the game. Just, you know, he got the and one, he was, like all teed up, which is fine. But, I just kind of, it's always just great battles between me and him, and it's always a respect thing where I just make it tough on him and then you make it tough on me. And there's plays, you know, where I play really well, you know, get him frustrated. And then there's times where he's Luka Doncic and he's going to, you know, get a bucket how he is in any way. And it's just the spirit, just him competing in both of us. So, he probably scored and got hyped and yelled, which is perfectly fine. Because on the other hand, if I get a key stop or do something, I'm the first one to yell and scream too. So. I already know how that goes.
And I wanted to make sure I pointed out that you had gotten him on the previous ISO because he was trying to just hammer you. I didn't want to be like, you're talking to PR people being like, this dude woke me up this early on the West Coast to tell me I got fucking beasted in the post by Doncic. Who's this guy? Because look, we know how good you are defensively. But if you look back to that bubble stretch, you're terrific. You know, to close, we're not sure if it's real or not. You know what I mean? You're like, okay, they were 14 under 500, something like that. The whole season's weird. We get it. And then Chris Paul comes in. What's the most impressionable thing that Chris said to you once he shows up? He's your teammate. Like something that maybe you'll never forget, a story you tell your buddies about the first time you get to experience playing with Chris Paul.
my biggest thing with C is just when he, especially when he first got here, is how much he talks. You know, like I've never been around a player that consistently talks throughout the whole game and just on defense, on offense, he's just, I don't know, maybe like a perfectionist. He wants to every single play, like, it's crazy. I was just like, dang, he's, I don't know how he's doing all this, he's still talking, and even if you mess up once, he's letting you know, and I'm like, I like to keep guys accountable and stuff like that. But yeah, I've never been around somebody that talks so much and is constantly just knows so much about the game and what he's saying. Just stuff, you know, maybe think about sometimes, and it makes you think the game even more. And, you know, I think I feel like I'm a pretty smart player and just not understand the game, but he will come with some stuff where I'm even to myself just like, that makes so much sense. I didn't even think of it like that. And that, like how he thinks is just so simple to him. So that's probably the biggest thing.
Is there an example from a game? Is there anything you can share with us? Like something you were like, oh, wow. Like, you know, only he thought of that.
Oh, my God. Right now I can't think of something because right now it's kind of, see, now I'm at the stage where I've been around so much, and so now he's my mind is starting to think like him. So it's like now whatever he says, I know because he's been telling me for a whole year, 2 years now. So now I'm starting to think like CP, and I feel like I got smarter dealing with him. So that's a big compliment to give to him. But it's so hard because it was really last year. He would say some stuff. I'm just sitting there like, dang, that does. But now, stuff he says now, and even more, I'm like, hell yeah. Like, I know that now. Like, because of you, you know, like, he says, like, little stuff that I didn't know before. I'm the one, maybe just when he was out or something like that, I'm the one telling somebody, you know, what he usually would tell me. And it's just like, I learned from him, but I really wish I had something like I could really just. That really, like, he told me something. I was really like, damn, that. I didn't even think of something like that. I think of that. I'm pissed.
I put you on the spot. It's early, too. So let's, if something pops in.
I watch it come back to me later. It's going to make me think about it. And I'm going to see him later and I'm going to look at him. And it's probably going to pop up. I already know.
All right. Well, look, if it interrupt me if something comes up that you want to remind us of. I have a few more things I want to get to here, but you mentioned. I can't imagine playing in a league and then checking social media. I just can't. I know you guys do it. I know you guys do it at halftime. How hard was it for you to check out anything after the finals last year?
I mean, not crazy. I just feel like, I don't know, just owning up. You know, I think that's the biggest thing personally. I ain't gonna speak for everybody, but I feel like just in a world, owning up makes things a little bit better if you kind of try to put it to the side and not try to look at things. It's kind of just going to dwell on you a little bit more. And obviously I was upset when we lost, but I just feel like, you know, like nothing to really obviously be upset and take it to the next year, but nothing to really hang our heads up on. You know, I don't think we had a hell of a year, you know, it's something we did was very special, and how close we are as a team is just, is not usual. So even when we lost, I was upset, frustrated, but I just took time and just realized, man, just like we had a hell of a year and we had fun and, you know, it's life, you know. I've been in championships and I've won and I've lost, and it's just, you know, it's a part of life, man. You just try your best and, you know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, and it's just part of life. And I just kind of know that, and life goes on, but you can learn from it, and I think that's what we're doing right now.
How motivated then do you think this group has been? Like, how much do you think this year's play? It's a really good team. You're deeper. It's another year of everybody understanding their roles and everything. But the bitterness of losing, even though it was a great season, how much do you think that has fueled what we've seen from the team this year?
For sure, it's just a lot of added motivation, and you've got a lot of players, man. Just a lot of proof, and we're just out here playing for each other. It's like it's not obviously that simple, but I think it's simple to us where we just got there, we play for each other, we play hard, and we love the game, and we love to compete. You know, we try to be the best team we can be, and obviously our end goal is to win it all, but, you know, it takes steps. You know, regular season is step one, and then just preparing round by round. But yeah, we're all motivated, man. We all got something to prove, and we just all want to win. You know, I think that's the biggest thing is there's nothing. Obviously, we all care about what each other do, you know, this about stats or stuff like that. But our whole thing, man, is every single guy wants to win. And it's not one guy that just wants to go out there and just be selfish and get the numbers and that's it. You know, they just, everybody wants to win. And that's what makes it so close and makes it so much fun to be out there.
Yeah. And that's also why, you know, Jay has his role. Booker's been amazing. And Ayton is the kind of modern big that you can keep on the floor, which is a big part. And he had some stretches last year to play. You're like, all right, what's this guy's ceiling? This is going to be incredible. Coming into the league and being teammates with Ayton for this long, how worried are you about where he could be after the season's over?
Yeah, I mean, I can't really talk too much about it, but obviously my biggest thing is that he should be here and starts to do whatever it takes to keep him here. He's just got better, you know, all throughout everything as a person, as a player, really matured, and I know he wants to be here as well. So that's all I can really speak upon.
I took a swing at it. I had to. So I had to, you know, look, I totally get it though. All right, final thought on this. Everybody knows the story about being drafted by the Sixers, the family connection of the whole deal, your connection to the area. And then, you know, it was like, oh no, I'm on Phoenix. We've been over this. Do you ever have moments like, I'd imagine in the moment you probably weren't thrilled, but then to see how it worked out, can you kind of take us through that as we finish here, the full circle of emotions of maybe not getting what you thought you wanted at the time to now being a situation where it probably couldn't be much better?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, when I got drafted, I definitely was frustrated. You know, I kind of looked myself in the mirror days after just because I felt like I wasn't being as grateful as I should. You know, I always dreamed about being in the NBA as a kid and not to just be in the NBA, but being in a green room and to go top 10 is just something I couldn't even think that would ever happen. And me being just so caught up with my feelings and my heart and wanting to be home, got me all screwed up when I got traded because I didn't think that would happen. And yeah, man, I had to look myself in the mirror, bro, and just tell myself just like, you know, what am I really upset about? You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, who cares? You want to go home, but it's life. You're top 10. You're going to a city where a team traded for you and they want you here. Like, why are you remotely upset about this? You know, like, this is a dream, this is top 10, and it made me realize, like, bro, I gotta be more grateful. And obviously I'm grateful in life for other things, but stuff like that, I'm like, it kind of, I had to look myself in the mirror, but come on, man, you can't be upset about not going where you wanted to go. You know, you went top 10, that is a blessing. You know, people fight every day to even get just a 10 day or be in the G League or stuff like that. And I was upset with myself with that for even letting that get to me. But yeah, man, I was upset. And then once I realized everything and how much, you know, they gave up and what they wanted to do, I was excited. Did I think we were going to be where we're at this fast? You want to be honest? Hell nah. But hey, you know, that's the James Jones up there and bringing in Mont and how he changed the culture so fast and getting the pieces, drafting, you know, getting Cam Johnson and T-Pain coming out of nowhere, coming back in the league, hooping, and, you know, obviously getting CP and Jay is just, you know, credit to them, man. And I'm just happy I'm a part of it. And I wouldn't want, if I go back draft night, I'll let the same shit happen again, bro. Trade me, let me go to Phoenix. Like, this is great how the story's getting written right now, and I'm enjoying every moment of it.
And yeah, man, you deserve it. And you got that extension. You put up numbers, people taking notice, and I love watching this team play. So I'm happy for you, man. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man.
This episode is brought to you by Arby's, the perfect sandwich. Let me think. Buffalo chicken sandwich is done right. Can change your life. I've never been the same in the best way possible when I experienced my first one. Also loving to travel, I've had gyros, also known as gyros. I think if you go to Arby's and you order a gyro, they're not going to judge you. And that's what I like about them. Nice chicken, perfectly sauced, butter lettuce, good body. You know what I'm talking about. And that's what Arby's has. They have more than you may even realize. Get out there and explore. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com.
Earlier on this podcast, we talked to the authors of The Cult of We, the story of WeWork. We Crash is now on Apple TV, 5 episodes in, 3 more to go. It comes out every Friday. I encourage you to check it out. The co-creators, Lee Eisenberg and Drew Crivello, join us now on the podcast. All right, look, I love the show. I love the story. I love all this kind of stuff. I feel like we're in this kind of like sinister CEO phase of content that's been going on for a couple of years, and this is one of my favorite stories. So honestly, I'll let either one of you jump in kind of at the start here. Let's start from concept. Like, give me the idea of either reading the book, the podcast with Wondery, all the IP that's out there, and then going like, okay, this is a show. How do we get this made? So Lee, I'll start with you.
Yeah. I mean, I'd known the Wondery guys for years, and they called me out of the blue and said, hey, we have a podcast that we're putting out about WeWork. We'd love for you to listen to it early on. If you're interested, let's try to set it up as a TV show. And I was like, great. And I had read a few articles about WeWork at that point, and I devoured the episodes that they were sending me. And I was like, the thing that I was kind of most excited about was this love story at the center of it between Adam and Rebecca. They just seemed like such fascinating characters. And I was kind of rooting for them at times. I was laughing with them. I was laughing at them. I was just like, there was just so much there. And Drew's one of my best friends, and we've been looking to do something together. And we ended up taking this walk in Beverly Hills, and I had sent him the podcast, and we both just started talking about it. And it was just one of those things where it just, you know, we had been reading each other's scripts. And, you know, again, we obviously shared very similar sensibilities. We just kind of kept coming back to this core relationship at the center of it. And it just felt like it clicked. And so I have a deal at Apple. We brought it into Apple, and they were just excited about the podcast and kind of the IP. And we just kind of went off on our own and started working on it. And it was that was January of 2020, right?
Yeah.
And it just kind of went from there. We just started working on it. The pandemic happened. We started working remotely. I mean, it was a crazy, weird way to kind of get a project off the ground, just the timing of it.
And Lee and I have worked in the business for, you know, 20 plus years. We turned in our pilot, right, our first episode, and our story Bible, right, which kind of lays out what the series is, on a Friday, and Apple greenlit it to series on a Monday. So it was just, the whole thing's been kind of a rocket ship. From that walk we took till now is about as fast as a project can move through Hollywood.
How different is it writing for a pilot that we already know the story versus just something you're creating out of thin air, other than it's a way easier to get it made when everybody already knows, but like the creative process of telling a story that's been told versus one you're making up?
You know, it's both easier and harder, right? It's easier in the sense of you've got these kind of milestones, right? Like even when we looked at the whole series, the whole story, we knew from day one, when they get that $4 billion, that's the midpoint, right? That's like the hinge that this whole story can turn on. So you kind of have these kind of goal, these posts that you can put in about this is the beginning, this is the middle, this is the end. That said, since we're trying to roughly you know, to kind of stick at least to an artistic truth, you also can't just put in any event or scene that you want. So you have to be kind of creative within these constraints. So anyway, it's both easier and harder.
I would also say that, I mean, you know, you have these, like Drew said, you have these moments that you're kind of barreling towards. But what's different, you know, from a podcast or from a documentary versus what we're doing is you're filling in all of the scenes that exist where like, but why did they do that? Why is he someone that like $1 billion is enough? He says he wants to be a trillionaire. Why is she someone that's like this? Like, and when you start kind of creating those psychological profiles, those are the same exercises that you end up doing with, you know, if you're creating a character from whole cloth. And so for us, as much as there exists of Adam, you have to keep scraping underneath the surface to kind of find the emotional truth of these people. And we weren't interested in doing something where it's like, oh, we were trying to do a hit piece on them, and we weren't kind of trying to say like, oh, every story should be we crashed, and that, you know, look at Adam, what a genius, he made 47, you know, his company was valued at this crazy valuation. We wanted to be three-dimensional, and to do that, it just takes a lot of work.
What I really like about the pilot, maybe I'm guilty of, you know, consuming so much of the content already through wondering the book, but I think sometimes when you're writing a pilot, if you're trying to sell the story that hasn't been sold before, I'm not just talking about like the economic part of selling, but selling the pitching it, where you're like, okay, how do I balance all these great things that I want to put in the pilot? Because there's no point in saving something for shit that's not going to get made versus I don't have to, you know what I mean? Like, I don't have to do it. And what I do like about the pilot is that, yeah, in the beginning, we get a sense of them forward in the timeline of like, this is where we're at. Now we're going to back it up. And so I know that's a process that's used a lot, but I'd have to think that there's some kind of storytelling advantage knowing we don't have to swing at like every single scene to get somebody to buy into this. And clearly that's not the case, because I mean, to have it turn around that quickly is amazing.
Yeah, you're saying, given that it's a true story, that you kind of can that you have that to kind of draft off of?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is, you know, not everyone is completely familiar with this story, right? Both in the audience and even at Apple. So we really kind of went in presuming people knew nothing. So we kind of approached the pilot assuming that even the executives we were trying to kind of get to greenlight this, let alone the audience, that they hadn't seen the doc, that they hadn't read any books, that maybe they caught a headline when this was going down, but maybe they hadn't. So we really kind of looked at this as, what if you know nothing about this, how can we still tell a fascinating story that anyone would enjoy?
I think we covered it then, because I feel like I asked the same question twice. Getting Jared Leto to sign off on this, how did that happen?
WME, our agency, my agency, sent it to him. And it was kind of one of those things where, you know, when you're starting to write something and writing is really long and tedious and filled with uncertainty, you often fantasize about the future because sometimes it's easier than actually doing the writing. So it's like, well, if we ever get it made, you know, it'd be incredible. It'd be, you know, Jared Leto. You know, you start kind of putting together the pieces and you're like, oh, well, he can do this and he can do that. And
it's more fun to cast it in your head than it is to actually write.
Yeah, exactly. And so we talked about Jared we talked about Jared probably on that first walk. I mean, it was just kind of something, he ticked off all the boxes for us. It's like some of the adjectives that we were talking about with Adam, it's like
messianic.
He's messianic. He's a rock star. He can, you know, he's charming. He's charismatic. He's handsome. And so it was like all of these things. And it was like, oh, okay, Jared Leto, sure. And the thing about Jared is he just disappears into every role. He just takes these crazy swings and just becomes somebody else. I mean, it's incredible. And so he read the script, and Jared is, you know, in his own right, he's an investor. Like, he knows the tech world more intimately than we do. And so we started talking about it, and it just became one of those things where all of the conversations were so aligned. I mean, he was like, I'm not interested in taking down this guy. I want to kind of find the humanity behind him. And it was so in line with where we were. And the interesting thing with both with Jared and with Annie is that, you know, they sign on to a movie script and they read the whole script. With this, we sent him 60 pages and a very, you know, a pretty looking Bible that, you know, we hired a graphic designer to add some pictures.
Which but we don't think they ever read, by the way.
Yeah, but like, so he read 60 pages, which ultimately ended up being a 480 page. If you're talking about like the number of pages that Drew and I and our writers generated, it's close to 500 pages. He read 60 pages and then me and Drew, you know, talking, somehow he was like, okay, I believe in you guys enough that I'll go on this journey and do TV for the first time and sign on to it. It was the same thing with Annie. It's like, you really had to make such a leap of faith.
And Ryan, you were talking about the pilot as kind of like, it's kind of a sales document, right? It's a sales document to the company that you're hoping will greenlight it. It's a sales tool to the audience that you're hoping will go on this journey with you. But it's also kind of a sales tool for the actors, right? That this is what they're using to base their decision on. And the one thing I think we did right was we were able in the pilot to give a glimpse of these two crazy, fascinating, flawed, strange people that Jared Leto and Anne Hathaway were like, I want to know more about them. Who are these people? And that really began this conversation.
Yeah, before I get to Anne, because she's, in a way, she's, I don't want to like rank them, you know, I'm a sports guy over here, but like I have her one of my power rankings for We Crash. Jared's, you know, a solid two.
Is he a 1A or is he 1A or 2?
But Jared, I don't know that much about it. The only Jared Leto story I have is I was doing a remote from the national championship for college football in Arizona, and we were doing it before the pregame. So it was me 3 hours live, and his band played in the parking lot, and he was swearing nonstop. And then we're a Disney company, so that's not a huge fit. And you could hear it over the, like, he didn't know what the hell was going on. We're just a tent with some ESPN logos up. And then they were like, hey, we got to figure out some way on the feedback on this because, like, they're not supposed to be on right now. I was like, I have a hard time believing that a PA from ESPN Radio is going to be able to tell Jared Leto's manager to, like, hey, could you guys give us another hour over here? So I hear these stories about him as an actor, you know, how engrossed in all of it he becomes, the method part of it. This is different than playing the Joker, certainly. But what is your experience? What's real about how much he invests in a character that definitely is a character in Adam Newman?
Well, I mean, Lee and I talk about this all the time. You know, we spoke to Jared in the development process when we were talking him through what the story would be. We spoke to Jared Leto for about 4 months until the day we started shooting. And the day we started shooting, we started with a couple of Annie scenes that day, and then Adam Newman walked onto the set and he was not Jared Leto. We did not address him as Jared Leto, and we did not speak to Jared for another 4.5 months. And then we spoke to him again on the day we wrapped. So that's how immersive it is. I mean, Lee and I, we would do Zooms with him on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday night and talk about script, and it would be accent, full character. Either the video was off or he would be in full character with the video on. That's how sort of uncompromising it was.
And also, I mean, I'm half Israeli. My dad's from Israel. And he was speaking English with an Israeli accent, and which is what I grew up with. I mean, all my parents' friends were like that. And it was just this way, you know, he'd come on to set, I'd say shalom to him, he'd say shalom back. I mean, I don't think Jared speaks more than 8 words in Hebrew, but like it just kind of felt like, okay, this is like an Israeli guy. He had a scene partner who was Israeli, and they would just run through lines. And then he was always kind of looking for like those little like specific touches. And the amazing thing is like now that the show's out there in the world, like when I had to show it to my dad, that was terrifying. And he gave the seal of approval. And then just like getting the feedback from all of these Israelis. It's funny, like there's a few people on Twitter that are like, his accent sucks. And it's like, all my Israeli friends are like, holy shit, how the fuck did he pull that off? Like, it's incredible. Like,
look, when you watch Adam Newman in interviews, which I've done also when I was doing the other stuff, the cadence, the pacing, the emphasis on the beats, like I was like, all right, we'll see how this goes. You know what I mean? Because this can go really bad. As a guy from Boston, as you know, like every now and then you're like, what's John Malkovich doing right now? And you know, and you go, I'm not sure. Or Ray Donovan, like, what town is his wife from? Like,
I've definitely, having grown up in Boston, I've definitely had the experience more with Boston accents where actors are taking swings and they're like doing like, you know, the Casey Affleck and Goodwill Hunting impersonation for like for everything. And what Jared did is like really subtle and deft.
It's not every word. Like, that's what everybody has to understand. Like, whenever you're doing accents, you can't do it every word. You know, that's always been the Boston one. Yeah. And I thought he, look, I think is his pacing, a lot of it. I think it's a lot of Adam Newman. And it's funny because, yeah, researching for the interview, then it's like, you know, some were critical of the accent. I was like, oh, no shit. I'm like, no kidding. Like, of course, somebody's going to get mad at it. Like, there was a Colombian buddy of mine at ESPN that was like, hey, that Pablo Escobar show on Netflix sucks. And I was like, what? Like, he's from Brazil. And I went, okay. I'm like, I apologize for, I did not notice that. I was not able to tell the difference between the Brazilian accent. Anyway, so Anne Hathaway. All right. Legendary, the whole deal. But she doesn't get the toys to play with. You know, she doesn't get the same toys with the physical part of Jared's character and the accent and all that. She doesn't have the same toys. But I feel like she represents the Rebecca that I learned about through all this, as well as any character in the show.
Absolutely. And I think she is doing some things with her voice. It's super subtle. And it's, I mean, she did a lot of yoga study because Rebecca was a yoga teacher. I mean, she committed just as much, if not more, than Jared, just in her own way. And I just think her performance is jaw-dropping.
I think the other thing too is to add to that is, you know, they both find their own kind of access points to characters, like what she does with her hair and her wardrobe. Like my wife, I just got married on Saturday. I haven't said that a lot. My wife,
there you go. Congrats.
Works at Vanity Fair and is a real fashionista, and all of her friends, you know, follows all the blogs and stuff like that. And getting the feedback from that side of it, where like, all these women are talking about, like, oh my God, that is exactly what Rebecca should have been wearing in 2013. Like, Annie was obsessive about wardrobe and costume, and like what props would, like what toys the kids would have, and you know, what type of glassware they'd have in their kitchen. So both Jared and Annie in different ways approach kind of like the creation of the characters. They have their own ways of doing it, but it's still, they're both incredibly immersive and just completely, you know, envelops them.
What I really like about the way you write it and the way she plays it out too is that the incremental annoyance would be the wrong word because that's only a sliver of it. It's her kind of finding her identity with this new role of this business blowing up, and she's both supportive. Like, you don't spend an hour of her, oh, this is the episode she's mad. Because in the episode, when she's realizing, maybe I don't like my position, maybe I need more, maybe, but then she's still a great wife to Adam. So I thought that was, you know, brilliant gets thrown around a lot, but I just thought that it was incredibly believable. It was like almost economic in the way that you would use it in the storytelling, so that it's incredibly believable by the time she's at episode 5, where, you know, at the end of it, she's deciding, like, I'm taking over here a little bit, and she's pissing everybody off, but it wasn't rushed. It was, I just thought that was really good storytelling because it's such an important part of it, because it isn't just Adam.
Thank you. Yeah. And we think that was kind of the story of WeWork, right? That like, as she saw it more and more as a vehicle for her to be what she wanted to be, she kind of insinuated herself more and more.
And I think that Rebecca is someone, you know, like I was saying before, it's like you have to create psychological profiles of your characters, right? And so Rebecca is someone who grew up with a lot of wealth, and her first cousin is Gwyneth Paltrow. So imagine what it must feel like to want to be an actress, and a person that you see at Thanksgiving every year is winning an Oscar and dating Ben Affleck and like all of these things. And it's like, what must it be like when people are like, so Rebecca, what are you working on? And she ends up leaving acting. She becomes a yoga instructor. She goes to India to study under the Dalai Lama. She's a searcher. And that's something that we found interesting about the character. And she keeps kind of trying to find her place in the world. And then ironically, she ends up marrying another superstar, a rock star. I mean, the end of episode 2 is her watching Adam at the JP Morgan conference. And Miguel turns to her and goes, some people just have it. And you just, her face in that last 8 seconds as the camera slowly pushes in on her, I think she's making 1,000 different expressions. I mean, I think she's proud, she's jealous, she's envious, she's angry, she's frustrated, she's happy. And you know, in episode 5, she's at the Time 100 party. And again, she's cast aside. And again, watching someone that's so close to her getting all the attention that she so wants for herself. And that to us was such an interesting, that kind of broke it open for us in terms of her character.
I connected to that scene because I remember going to events with Van Pelt where they would be like, hey, just can
you hold the purse?
Can the other guy stand
a little more
further
to the
way? And I had my Rebecca moment after that. I was like, I'll never let myself feel this way again. All right. I think there is some part of this because, you know, we wanted our pound of flesh because of the financial disaster part of this story. This is not the show for you. And I think you guys have been upfront about this, that this is a love story wrapped in a business that failed. You've both, I don't know if I, you know, with all the notes that I have, I think maybe Lee, you would compare it to Theranos. And I would agree with you. Elizabeth Holmes was misdiagnosing people with cancer that didn't have cancer and telling other people they had AIDS. I mean, you know, it was disgusting what she did. But I think Adam clearly knew that this wasn't sustainable, but loved the lifestyle part of it. And I don't know if that's where it goes, because obviously I haven't watched the rest of the episodes and I kind of like the once a week thing. It feels old fashioned, but it's kind of look forward to it a little bit. How did you balance, you know, you said it before, like this wasn't going to be a hit piece, but the reality that, yeah, it wasn't as criminal as Theranos, but he fucked up.
Yeah, so I think, you know, that was something that we wanted to kind of make as provocative as possible, right? That really, this is a series that kind of exists in the gray, right? And I think it would have been too easy to just present them as caricatures, right? That would like to easily judge them. I think what we're trying to do here is really kind of ask this dramatic question. Was this guy, and were he and Rebecca, were they idealistic visionaries that went wrong? Or were these cynical opportunists that he just saw a way to make money and how to like wrap it all in this shiny millennial kind of dream, and he just kind of exploited people? And that the show is kind of an exploration of that. So yeah, we very purposefully wanted to make it gray because it also then makes it bigger than just Adam and Rebecca, right? There's a lot of players in this story and we want people to kind of debate that.
Lee?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, Adam famously did a 12-minute tour of WeWork with Masa, and at the end of it, Masa writes on the laptop, it's the end of episode 4, $4.4 billion. And you're like, wow, he's only the world's greatest salesman would be able to convince someone of giving up $4.4 billion. And then it's like, well, hold on, let's look at it the other way. What kind of person hears a 12-minute sales pitch and says, you know what, I'm in for $4.4 billion. And all of these people, when you look at all these financial institutions, the VCs, the banks, they take these crazy swings. They love that Adam Neumann didn't wear shoes. It's a narrative, right? Like, they're all of these, the fact he's tall, he has an accent, he has long hair like Jesus. Like, there's all this, we talked a lot about FOMO. We talked a lot about all of these banks. There's a scene coming up where all the banks are kind of competing for WeWork's business. And all of those banks stand to make hundreds of millions of dollars if they just are able to underwrite the IPO. And so all of those mechanics, all of those different institutions, all of those levers of power, that's what the show also is hinting at. Like, we didn't want to just tell the story of Adam and Rebecca. You see that all of these institutions that are coming at them, throwing money at them like crazy, like it takes a lot to be calm and modest. And the fact that Adam is a narcissist, the worst thing that you could ever give Adam Neumann is $4.4 billion. You think like, oh, okay, like they're, you know, they can buy their way out of this, and they're, you know, and all Masa says to him is you need to be crazier.
Yeah, no, I get that part of it. And then you even to this point have the Jamie Dimon chase scene where he wants a line of credit and they're handing him a water bottle, and Jamie Dimon's like, instead of $50 million, you need $100 million, exactly because you said they want his IPO business later on. So here are the loans. I mean, all the mortgages and all the loans that he had on all these properties, he's buying them up left and right. It is a little shady, though, I would say, on the execution of some of the stuff for him to be the only person that was allowed to be doing this against the shares. And I guess there were different parts in the podcast where I was like, how serious can I take this guy when he's pitching Elon Musk WeWork on Mars? So I don't know if that's back to the Masa part where it's like just be crazier and crazier, because there are a lot of people that tell, you know, history, the winners, and a lot of the winners are telling you, like, I did all these crazy things, right. I made all these decisions. And I think there's another generation of people that are just influenced by that, thinking they can do no wrong because the banks haven't cut them off yet. So I get that part of it where it isn't the hit piece.
I mean, actually, yeah, the one thing, Lee and I, when we first started talking about this and like, and took that first walk, we were going to start this off in Holland during tulip fever, right? Like, and we were going to then go to the gold rush in California. And we were going to kind of jump through these times of, and we were going to have the same actor play that character throughout time. So we were just going to kind of show that it both takes these kind of snake oil salesmen, but also it's a sign of the times, right? And so it's a little bit of a chicken and the egg, but just how these cycles and bubbles keep kind of recurring.
And that's, you know, the thing too, it's like, you know, there was a unicorn stampede and it was Uber and WeWork and Theranos and all this stuff. And it's like, everyone talks about unicorns and it's like, unicorns don't exist for a reason. You know what I mean? And it's like, everyone so wants to be part of the thing. I mean, it's Shark Tank. It's a lottery ticket. And when they hit, like Masa invested, I can't remember how much, $200 million or whatever it was in Alibaba, turned into 30 right. billion.
Yeah.
What, right? 20 million. 20 million. Yeah.
20 million. And so you look at something like that and you're like, is this guy have the Midas touch? Is Masa a genius? And it's like, for every one of the Alibabas before and after that, there are hundreds of companies that he completely whiffed on. And so, you know, it's like you look at these guys and it's like, oh, is he a master investor? It's like, no, he takes crazy swings. And when you take crazy swings, yes, you're going to hit a few out of the park.
All right. This question's for Lee, but I mean, your story's pretty incredible when you think about going from Vance Refrigeration, like, and then now you're in Hollywood. And then, I don't know, did Jim and you ever talk about like your goals?
What's that? Then? Did what?
I'm just fucking with you. This is back to a joke that I've shared with the audience. Is we had John in studio once promoting a movie at ESPN. It was just him and I. And I was kind of like, do I take a big swing here and just try something really stupid and something different and pretend the office was real and be like, like, I can't, like, this is huge for you, man. Like, you've blown up and take it seriously. And I played it straight because I was like, I don't know him. I was like, this will whiff. And then we went to commercial. He was super nice. And I was like, hey, I was going to try this thing. And he was like, oh, that would have been really funny. And it was code for like, that was fucking a stupid idea. Like, I could tell the way he gave me kind of the blow off, like, oh yeah, that would have been funny. For those that don't know, Lee worked on The Office for a long time, and you were one of the drug dealers, right?
I was best known for all my 5 years on The Office. I was best known for playing Gino of Vance Refrigeration. Yes. And you know, all the, you know, the evolution from Gino and my four episodes that I get residuals from to writing Wheat Crash, is, you know, it's a natural progression of Hollywood.
No, but there are subtle things. I'm not saying like I'm always able to detect it. And I know, you know, your career outside of that in comedy is terrific, but I think people that can write comedy as well, and just the subtle things in The Office, I still, you know, I've talked about it before on the podcast. They're brilliant. There's things you don't always catch the first time. There's just, you know, like something as dumb as when Dwight turns to the camera and says, I see dead people, or he was dead the whole time. And I just think about the writer's room being like, did Rain know to do that? Or would somebody in the writer's room be like, you know what would be brilliant is if Dwight turns and goes, he's dead the whole time, blowing the Sixth Sense suspense. I think when you learn like those beats that are that subtle, then I'm not saying like drama is easier, but I feel like when you have that background, like you guys do, and certainly those years in The Office with you, Lee, I think it sets a template for like some really incredible stuff. You can be subtle, you can be funny without distracting from everything else you're doing.
I think that, you know, we talked a lot about tone with this, and John Recco and Glenn Ficarra, who did This Is Us and Crazy Stupid Love and Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, like,
and they wrote Bad Santa.
I mean, we talked about kind of like, you know, they talked a lot about mixed tone. And that was something that Drew and I mean, there's so much comedy in the story of WeWork. And, you know, you'd hear from, you know, we talked to former employees and people that knew Adam and Rebecca. And there are times where they're ridiculous. And we didn't want to shy away from that. We also didn't want the jokes to be, like I said before, it's like we weren't looking to kind of just take swings at them always. And so, you know, with this show, you know, we have the scene where Rebecca is performing with the Russian accent and she takes this big swing and does that really kind of rocky accent. And that scene's funny. And we had a lot of conversations with Annie about what it meant. And what's really most important about that is not that scene and not the laughs that come from that scene. It's the moment afterwards where she realizes that she'll never have a career in this and it doesn't matter. And she's in the staircase by herself. She has the flowers that Adam gave her and she just breaks down. And that to me, as I mean, in all seriousness, as I kind of think about the way my writing has evolved, those types of scenes and the mix of one of those scenes to the next, that's what interests me most as a storyteller. And, you know, even, you know, going so far as far back as The Office, I mean, one of the things we talked about on The Office so much, we would spend the amount of time we spent on Jim and Pam and trying to get that story done right for how much screen time it got. We spent, I mean, it was probably 50-50 with that and like, you know, what Dwight talking heads about, like, you know, skinning a raccoon and how delicious like the inner flesh is of a raccoon. Like, you're just weighing those things equally, even though one of them, you know, is 10%, but it's all those small touches. And I think when you connect to characters, when an audience can connect to characters and laugh with them, laugh at them, but also just feel that pathos, that to me is, it's really hard to pull off, but that's the thing that I'm always gunning for. And that's what we were trying to do so much in the show.
Was the Andy acapella thing based on Coco Beau from Connecticut College?
My old writing partner, Gene Simnitsky, read some article somewhere that people from Cornell were really, had like kind of an inferiority complex in terms of the Ivies. So that's how the Cornell part arrived. And then I think because Ed sings, I think we just started talking about it. I wish the Coco Beau was the inspiration.
Because the only reason I remember is because growing up on the vineyard and being there during the summer is those guys started hanging out and like they would just break out in song. And I think it's a very known thing. Now there's not a lot of guys going, you've got to meet my friends from this acapella group. They're the best. You know what I mean? And which is shitty. It's, I know I'm dumping on the acapella fraternity here. I respect the talent. I respect it all. But then they changed their name to the Vineyard Sound. So the natives started being like, you guys are from like Westport. You know, we don't, what's going on here? So I always wonder if there was that connection there.
Not a fun fact, but I auditioned for the Coco Beau and like, I didn't just get rejected. It was like, I can't sing. I think I'm tone deaf. And I auditioned cause I was like, oh, these guys are cool. So that things have gotten better since then, but those are early days.
All right. I got to bring it back. Cause I don't want to lose everybody. Like, what the hell are they talking about? But I was in the chorus when I was in Drew's like, wait, how long is this?
These are some deep cuts.
these really are. All right. I'll start with you here, Drew. Did Adam, Rebecca was there any consultation?
None. We purposely,
people don't believe you, huh?
Yeah, no, we purposefully stayed away. I mean, we knew that, you know, we wanted to really kind of tell the story we wanted to tell. And like, if we let them into the process, like we wouldn't have been able to go the places that the show goes. And so we just kept them at arm's length and just kind of told our story.
By the way, that's the best. I can imagine those two being like, yes, we'd like to be involved in this. So I kind of knew the answer, but it's just weird reading a lot of stuff about it. People were like, oh, you know, there's probably, okay, here's the final question though. Cause I think we all know the answer to this one. Lee, do you think that they've watched the show?
I think they've definitely watched the show. And it's funny, I spoke to someone who knows them. I said, do you think they would watch the show? And they go, they would absolutely watch the show. I mean, also you have Jared Leto and Anne Hathaway playing you. I mean,
yeah.
I do believe that they're narcissists. The lethal combo of narcissism and two Oscar winners playing you. I don't think they're tuning into, you know, Ptolemy Gray or something.
Yeah. There's no, like, you know, they're like, actually, we're way into Severance right now.
So when it drops, at midnight, they're tuning in.
That's my favorite part. Is you, especially on the West Coast, I'll be like, oh wait, I got it right. I got it a day early. So there you go. If you're on the West Coast, it'll be Thursday nights. It's Friday for everybody else. It's on Apple TV. It is terrific. It's We Crash, and I want to thank Lee and Drew again.
Thanks so much.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Authenticity Guarantee. When it comes to your feet, eBay's got your back. When you see the blue check mark that says Authenticity Guarantee, that means real experts are checking your sneakers, every stitch, down to the sole. They'll even smell them because nothing says fresh like the scent of real kicks. So kick back and relax. From the drop to your doorstep, eBay doesn't play games with your sneaker game. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal with eBay Authenticity Guarantee. Visit ebay.com for terms.
This episode is brought to you by Lincoln in the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid. Featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God. The world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.
You want details? Bye. I drive a Ferrari 355 Cabriolet. What's up? I have a ridiculous house in the South Fork. I have every toy you can possibly imagine. And best of all, kids, I am liquid. So, now you know what's possible. Let me tell you what's required.
Lifeadvicerr@gmail.com. We got a mustache filter from Kyle here.
You got it.
Is that from Max Homa?
Sure. Yeah, let's put a reason on it.
All right. Love it. I almost texted Homa where I was like, hey, can we talk about, do you have like 10 minutes today? On the Masters, just to see if you'd be like, are you an asshole? Like,
just see how much of a people pleaser it really is.
No, I did call him once on a Sunday during a tournament when he got cut. And I was like, hey, what are you doing? He's like, are you serious? I was like, oh, I actually had a question. He's like, yeah, I didn't make the cut. I'm like, no, I know. That's why I called. He's like, well, he's like, I'm golfing. And I was like, yeah, no, I was like, it was actually a very serious question. It needed to be answered. And he was not upset about it, but it was, I think he was kind of like, wait, did you not know I made the cut? Or did you think I was, and you just called me on a Sunday? But he was out grinding, folks. So I'll just tell you that. So we'll see how that plays out for him by the time this releases. Okay. We had a lot of response to the fiance saying he didn't want his fiance. I don't know that we've ever had this many people agree on the same thing. The baby arms thing, I'm not even going to bother. 100 emails on baby arms may have been 50-50 down the middle. Like, you don't get bigger arms from holding babies. Guys giving me arm size increases, you absolutely do. Saruti, you're shaking your head right now. There's 50 emails here from guys claiming you absolutely get bigger arms. And the thing is, I think it's a lot about training. Like, certain guys be like, I just do calves and genetically they just don't get any bigger. And then other guys are like, you can figure out a way to work it out the right way. All of us are different. You need to find your routine. I do think the genetic calf thing is a little bit true, but you're so dismissive of this baby arms thing. I got 50 adult males here ready to tell you you're wrong.
I'm not saying that your arms can't get a little bit more toned or get slightly bigger. My issue was, the guy said he was jacked. Like, his arms are literally too big because of the baby. That's impossible. Like, yeah, you can go up and get a little bit stronger and, you know, maybe look a little bit more ripped. You're not getting bulky and too big because you're holding a baby. I'm sorry.
I don't know.
Think you're sorry.
Yeah,
you're right. I'm not sorry. Actually, you know what? You're right. I'm not sorry.
I don't think you're sorry, pal.
No, I got called a D-bag pretty heavily this morning on Twitter because I sent out the Jokic Embiid double team tweet because I've seen a lot of blue checks. It was basically for the blue checks. So I'm like, stop saying the reason Embiid's the MVP over Jokic is he gets double teamed more, because the reason Jokic doesn't get double teamed as much is because people are afraid to leave the shooters and leave the cutters because he dices them up passing, as we heard in that Timberwolves game where Timberwolves staff was screaming, stay home, stay home, stay home, stay home, stay home. So when I see like really educated basketball people saying, well, Embiid gets doubled more, so he's the MVP. Like, he may be the MVP, but that's not the reason, because it's different basketball philosophies. All right, needed to get that one off my chest. Because that's when I say something like that, it's usually aimed at like a handful of people. It's very specific. It's not me actually trying to be like, I'm so smart and I understand basketball. It's me being like, how come smart basketball people are pretending this is not the reason why this is happening? All right, so well, back
ran to- out of time in the open, huh?
Yeah, right, right. So I don't know. I don't know what else to say on the big arms thing. We're going to disagree. I think this kid might just have, you know, when he works the arms, when they're engaged, you know, those aminos start flying and there you go. But people were all over the place. Everyone agreed, though, about the guy not wanting his fiance to go to the wedding or whatever. I don't think we saw one thing from anybody. We had some other people like this guy got lit up in the responses. And I'm not sure
there's much value to be. I mean, we ripped them apart for 20 minutes. I think the limbs are in the woods in different sections. So, right? Are we all on the same page? Do we need more on this?
That was great. Funny meme, frame it. You're famous now, dude. Good for you.
Because I did retweet the guy that was like, you go on your favorite pod. Think that was him? I don't think it was him.
No, I don't think. He made sure to tell people. He's like, just so you guys know, I'm not the guy.
Okay. He did say that? All right. I missed that part.
I'm not the mark.
I just, because you got to imagine that guy's like, do I want to listen to this podcast anymore?
I would love to have that guy on though and be like, you thought this was going to go way differently. I want to break down like exactly where he thought that we were going to side with him on any of these different things, because he was universally wrong by the three of us and basically all of social media.
We've never had any topic on life advice that has had that much agreement ever. Yep. Like we could have a murder where there'd be guys going, I don't know. but we usually keep, we don't usually do the murder ones we get. Yeah, we try to stay away from those. Okay. All right, we'll do a gym one. Has it been a little while since we've done a gym one?
I think it's been a while.
All right. 34, 5'9", 155. But people say I look 165. Well, holy shit, man. That's great news. Never maxed out, could do 20 pull-ups. But maybe since I'm only pulling 155, good for you. No desire to be super ripped. Just want to look decent at the beach. Okay, man. Got it. Some of you guys are giving us some intense prologues to the email about your body type.
I respect that, though. Because if there's a guy who's like, I just want to get ripped to look good at the beach, like, I don't know if I'm hanging out with that guy. If there's a guy's like, hey, I just want to look good. Don't want people to embarrass myself in front of everybody else. Then yeah, that's good. That's a totally different vibe.
Do you ever want to get Jack Cerruti?
No, never.
You would hate it. You would not want to.
I described, like, if I ever wanted to get, and I don't really work out a ton in that way, and my bench would probably be embarrassing, whatever my max is. I don't even know what it would be, to be honest with you. I think I could do 135, but it's been a while. But I don't like those dudes that are too big. I would want to be like rock star Rick, where I'm just skinny, but like you could see the muscle kind of situation. But you
really? You like that skinny, effeminate thing?
I probably have to do way more drugs to get that kind of body too. But no, I would never want to be bulky. Never.
Kyle, you want to be jacked. I know deep down you want to be.
I want to be, you know what they say? I think toned is the word. I want to be toned. What do you think about that?
I think that's fair.
Wait, so Cerruti, you said you don't like those guys. Like, you don't like the weight on them, or you just don't really want to be friends with them?
One of my best friends is a bulker. He's huge. And I tell him all the time, like, I think you kind of look ridiculous. Like, you're too big.
How much does he weigh?
Such thing. Well, he's short, too. So there's a little bit of an overcompensation thing. He's 5'7". He loves to tell us that he's average, which is fine. But he's definitely like the most jacked out of all my friend group. But there's a reason he's jacked. It's because he's the shortest guy in the friend group.
5'7", average?
And, you know, he's too wide, and he's like, it's not like a fat thing. He's not like, he's pretty much all muscle, but it just looks too bulky. It's not my preferred body type. Sorry.
Yeah. All right. No, all established. Okay. So back to the email. I've been going to my current gym for about a year now since moving to a new country. It's pretty standard. He doesn't tell me which country, by the way. Most people know what they're doing. Trainers walking around doing trainer things. About halfway through my workout today, a new trainer about my height and build came right up to me in the middle of a set. Obnoxiously close. I stopped, took off my headphones, and asked, "What's up?" He proceeded to correct my form, then walked over to the dumbbell rack and brought me lighter weights. Jeez.
Hard out.
I was doing lateral deltoid raises with 12 kilograms. All right. He said my elbows weren't high enough. I think that puts us at, 25-pound dumbbell? Get somebody on that. he said my elbows weren't high enough. I humored him for about a minute and just said, okay, I put back all the weights without doing a second set. Moved on to a new workout. Oh, wow. First set interruption. You just said, screw it, new routine. Isn't it an unwritten rule to not give unsolicited form advice to someone unless they are clearly a novice or doing something that's dangerous? I'm no Russillo, but I'm obviously someone who's familiar. I wouldn't say all my form is all that great. Female trainer came up to me, Equinox. She was watching my squat. She's like, I think you need to kind of tweak something here. And I'll tell you, I didn't love it. I didn't love it right away. But you know what? She was right. She had me change my foot placement and maybe 10% stronger immediately. And now we're great friends.
Do you think if it was a guy, you'd be writing into this? And if it wasn't a female trainer?
I'll admit the fact that I didn't know anyone at the time when she did it, I was kind of like, what?
and
seriously gonna punk me right here in front of
everybody?
But
I mean, it was a very small adjustment. She's like, move your right foot up another like inch or so here. And she's like, you'll notice it in your hips. She's like, and keep the pressure on the outside. And I was like, oh my God. Like, she just unlocked. So now I'm surprised I didn't propose to her. But like right there. Like, what are you doing later? So I think it's, this is shitty though. This is, as you're doing it, he interrupts you as you're doing the actual motion. That's unheard of. Again, my only time I've ever done anything, I don't even think it's a handful of times, I'll see some young kid doing some sort of shoulder exercise where he has way too much fucking weight because he can get a few reps. He thinks he can handle it. And all I'm watching him do is like, you're going to fuck yourself up. And I used to do military overhead, way too much weight. And I have a recurring thing in my shoulder blade that's just never going to go away. It's better now, but it goes. It just goes because I did it wrong. So I see a younger dude doing this and I get it. Like, being a really skinny kid growing up, you want to show that you can do some stuff. So that's the only time I ever interrupt. And I've got to see a guy that looks like he's going to absolutely wreck him. Over a certain age, I'm like, fuck it. I'm not, you're a guy, I'm a guy, I'm not going to help. And I'm not pretending that I have everything down perfectly. Anyway, this is, you're right. You're right to be annoyed by this, because mid rep, stand right next to you and all that stuff. Now, originally when we were reading this, I thought, never underestimate like trainers trying to get clients and just going up to people and being like, hey, maybe I can help. But this is clearly not the way to do it. I would say any trainer that's listening to this would agree. And even if this person is pushing training sessions and that kind of stuff, this is the best way to not get hired to do any of these training sessions. So you're totally in the right. He did send a picture. Hey man, good looking guy. I don't really know what the picture tells us. Looks like there's some shoulder definition. Again, his shirt isn't off. It's sort of it looks like an avatar picture on top of everything else. I don't think there's really much debate here. I know what he's saying. Like, the elbows need to come up a little bit higher on that thing and you get that nice burn. On this kind of stuff, you should always go kind of light, honestly, because it's more about the movement and getting that burn in there than going super heavy on some of these things. And I think there's just some shoulder weird stuff that can always, you know, that's when you go a little heavy with that stuff, man. As you get older, it can get a little, you know, I fuck myself up. That's usually every 6 months. That's how I'll fuck myself up. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't have read this one. Maybe it wasn't super interesting.
Did he send you a picture of his form, or he sent you a picture of himself? What was the picture? Did he like have somebody show, was he showing you what he was doing when he was corrected, or what was this picture?
Nope, not even close. Bathroom mirror going on in the background, but it's kind of spun the other way. Yeah. I mean, honestly, it looks like, if he were, I don't know, like if there were a woman involved, it'd be like, hey, this is what I look like kind of picture.
Got it.
But there are no women on the show. So
nope.
He also said that his mother is a 65-year-old Jamaican that is a regular listener of the pod.
Wow.
That's amazing. Cause you know, my love for Jamaica, that's one of the coolest things ever. So shout out to the mom here. Although now, wait, did we expose him to the mom? She listens to the pod all the time. No, we took his side. He's just lifting.
No,
we're good here. Yeah. Let's not be hypersensitive to.
Congrats on your son.
Yeah. He sounds like a great kid.
On your hot
takes. Yeah. He's a good looking guy. Takes a hell of a picture.
I want to know, did she start listening to the pod because of him or vice versa? Like, who listened to the pod first? Right. Did he was like, hey mom, I got this sick pod. You should check this out. Priscilla, what's up?
He's like, just fast forward to the end.
Maybe she remembers time code. Maybe she remembers me from Risky Business. That's a club in the grill. They were like, Ryan, I told you that story, right, Sarudi?
Where
he was like annoyed that when I was DJing, I wasn't talking enough. And the guy that ran it was like, hey, you need to talk more. I was like, I don't really want to do that. And he was like, well, he goes down here. He's like, they talk at the beginning of the song. They talk like in the middle of the song and the songs go quicker. And then you sort of play the same song like 10 times in a row.
Yeah.
And
remix.
He's like, you've never experienced anything like it. He's like, and then talk at the end. And he goes, and when you think you're not talking enough, talk a little bit more. Or no, this is the way he said it. He goes, when you think you're talking a little too much, talk a little bit more. That was what it was. And then the guy came over that ran the place. And it was crazy. His name was Brian Jardin. And he looked like, I don't know, he looked like.
This is like Brian, your own version of the guy at the gym. He's like giving you an unsolicited DJing advice.
He owned the place. He owned the club. He owned Margaritaville. And he came up to me and was like, Ryan, you know, and it's crazy because the guy looked like Bryan Cranston and just full blown Jamaican accent, which people don't understand about Jamaica is that it's actually means like of many people. So there's like you could have somebody who looks like your buddy's dad who's an accountant and it's full blown patois, you know, like you're like, oh, whoa, what the fuck? So anyway, they didn't love me because I was like, you know, I don't really want to just, you know, throw T-shirts and scream how you doing all day long. And they're like, yeah, that's kind of what it is. That's almost exactly. I was like, I thought I was just playing music. And they're like, no, you got to like, you got to do other stuff too.
You're a hype man too.
Yeah. No. I was like, not no, you. No, I was like, I'm bad at that. Bad teases.
You should respond like, you ever heard Cascade's voice? Exactly. You know, you ever heard Calvin Harris talk? Nope. Here you go.
Sorry, not sorry.
I have no idea. I got to save this life advice. All right, let's get to a sports debate here. 31 years old. I've thought about pivoting some of this where we have guys who've sent in emails about debates and they want a ruling on it, which is sort of life advice, but we could call it Judge Kyle. I don't know. I know how much Kyle loves the courtroom shows.
So I like
get at this. But,
huge fan.
All right, so this will be a little more conversational and not take forever to get through what was a pretty simple thing that we should have done. The efficiency rate, we're about 12. The VORP is real low on this one today. All right, 31 years old, 6'1", 180. Solid off-ball scorer that can handle point when needed and consistently grab rim. Sweet, what's up? There's been a debate within a group of my friends which spans several years, and I figure with Ryan's expertise with the NFL salary cap and ability to weave through the nuances of sports take. Okay. Thus far, the group is split down the middle. The question is this. Playing in either the NFL or tennis, which sport would Spider-Man make the most money? Okay, Cerruti, can you look up all, like, full value of Nadal or Federer peak years, considering all of the endorsement stuff, too? And then look up Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, full, not just what his salary was, but endorsement shit as well, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hold on, give me a second.
No, no, no. Look that up. I'm going to keep reading. Yeah, and Kyle, you double
Manning.
You're on Manning?
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead. Kyle, do the tennis, guys.
Kyle's locked in.
All right.
So, Rudy, you do tennis. That makes more sense.
Well, his total body type?
Yeah, and just your vibe in general. Okay, so which sport would Spider-Man make the most money? His total income would include salary, bonuses, incentives, and most importantly, endorsements. Also important to know, everyone is aware of the guy is Spider-Man. All right. So he plays in his suit. He's Spider-Man. The only caveat is he cannot use his webs during games. Fair. Super strength, spidey sense, all are fair game. As a result, we all agree that regardless of sport Spider-Man plays, he's going to be the best player in the league. The group can also agree he would likely make the most money playing professional soccer as it's the most viewed sport in the world. Here are a few key points we always come back to. Pro tennis Spider-Man argument. Tennis is a much more popular sport globally compared to the NFL, where the NFL isn't necessarily popular outside of the United States. Spider-Man would likely win every tournament, so his winnings would eventually add up to a solid NFL year salary. He said Wimbledon winner in 2021 took home $2.4 million. I don't know. I don't know if your single year earnings, if you won every tournament, I don't know that off the top of my head. This is why I have research IT department here. So we're looking into this. You know, at the top end of what a quarterback would make, 40, $45 million, say, average annual salary in the NFL. I don't know if you can win that in tennis. Again, I don't know. I'm just saying it out loud. With tennis being a much larger global sport, someone with the popularity of a superhero, plus being the most dominant player in sports history, he would make so much money in endorsements, it would be like characters from The Boys mixed with Michael Jordan. All fair. Pro football argument. The cap is going up. Sure is, buddy. Thanks for listening. If Mahomes could make $50 million a year, what would a guy who could throw further, run faster, jump higher, and likely won't get tackled by non-radioactive spider-bitten players get paid per year? Even though the NFL isn't as globally recognized as tennis, the sheer weight of freaking Spider-Man playing quarterback would give him enough endorsements to make up the secondary pay gap. A team would pay the other 52 players on the roster the minimum and pay whatever is left from the salary cap to pay Spider-Man. Still up for debate on if this would yield a winning team. I've thought about this.
Me too.
I've thought about Spider-Man playing in the NFL for years, so that's why I was like, great pick, Kyle, great pick. All right, let's run over some of the tennis numbers, Surdy. It looks like you may have some of them.
Well, so Federer's made more than Nadal. So let's just do Federer.
Okay.
$190 million. When did this article come out? This is 2022. Okay. $190 million in earnings on the court. And he has a net worth of about $500 million.
All right, but that's not what we're interested in. Those net worth websites are always wrong. Do you have, is there a way you can figure out what he made in a single year? Like, do top, go 20 2019.
This says $84 million in endorsement earnings, tops among all athletes, dwarf Djokovic and Nadal.
For a single year?
That looks like, no, that can't be. $84 million in a year? That seems high.
I don't think it is, man. It's definitely not for his career.
This says Sportico estimates the 20-time Grand Slam champion has earned at least $1 billion during his career from prize money, endorsements, and appearance fees since he turned pro in 1998.
Okay, so I just looked up in 2019 Forbes' highest paid athletes. So this is everything they made both in their respective sport and everything they made outside of it. So McGregor made $180 million. Messi made $130 million. Ronaldo made $120 million. Dak Prescott made $107 million. Which is more than Federer's $90 million. Lewis Hamilton made $82 million. Neymar made $95 million. LeBron made about $100 million. All right, so that's all of it. So this actually tells us Dak being the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys and being good, but not, I wouldn't put him in the great category in the NFL, that he made more than Federer. Here's the thing. Is even though there's a global part of this, is a superhero playing a sport, you know, the NFL is not soccer. I think soccer makes it totally unfair because it'd be insane. I also wonder how Spider-Man would be at F1 with just the spider sense alone. You have to think, and he's not jacked, so it's not like he's the biggest guy ever. It's not like putting, you know, the Hulk in a Renault or something, right? I think it's the NFL because you could pay him whatever you wanted. You could pay him $100 million of the cap, and you'd win every game. Because think about it. With Spider-Man, he's just going to jump over everybody all the time. And he has a spider sense on top of that to anticipate anybody tackling. There's nothing you're going to be able to do with him. Hell, he could just play wide receiver and you could throw it straight up in the air and he'd go up and get it. So there's nothing you can do. You can't put 11 at the goal line. He's just going to jump over those guys. There's no defense that's going to stop Spider-Man. He's going to score every single possession. So I think you could put 10 scrubs out there with him, give him all of the money, and it wouldn't matter about the rest of the cap. Whereas tennis, yeah, sure, he's going to win. I mean, he's going to be awesome. He's going to be awesome. There's a lot of sports I can't imagine he's not going to be good at. But I still think the NFL here would play out a little bit better because the endorsement part of being Wilt Chamberlain and also a superhero in the NFL, it'd be beyond Wilt Chamberlain. Again, it's not real, as I'm probably pretending it's a little too real. But go ahead, Cerruti.
Maybe a stupid question, but like, would he be allowed to use his webs in an NFL game?
That's okay, in the email.
So. Yeah. So it's out. Okay. So that's out. Sorry, I was doing research. Never mind.
I mean, other than like them letting defenders, the secondary have crossbows, I don't really know how you would stop it. And then again, if a crossbow hit a fan, I don't know, the ratings probably wouldn't go down still with the NFL, but attendance might dip a little bit.
As we've learned.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Put some nets up.
Yeah. No, but I've thought a lot about the NFL superhero thing. Because like if you said, okay, Spider-Man, clear advantage, bunch of different stuff. We've already been over that. Superman just seems stupid. He's unfair. Can fly. If Batman were in the league, he'd probably just get fined for uniform violations the entire time. So I actually don't think Batman would be all that good.
Batman would be a tough teammate too. I don't think he'd last.
Yeah, right. You're like, what's this guy? Ton of off-field interests. Wolverine would never miss any games. He can't use his claws. It's ridiculous, right?
But yeah, but he could tear his ACL and heal himself immediately. He's fine.
Yeah, he could blow out an ACL and you have somebody on the sideline being like, Wolverine's good to go in the third quarter. That's a great point. That's a great point. Captain America, no shield. Yeah, I know he's super athletic and everything, but I think the speeches, there'd be a little Tebow vibe eventually with the teammates, or they'd be like, Russell, hey, man. Wilson. Yeah, like, we fucking get it. Like, we've done a lot. We've done a lot for the country. But, like, you know, we get the Steelers. We get the Steelers this week.
He beat one of your opens by year three. Like, all right, we've enough already.
Iron Man, don't be ridiculous. The Hulk would be killing people. That's not cool. Get suspended by the league. Black Panther, I thought about that. But then, you know, the NFL, they probably make him a running back. And those guys don't make that much anymore. Black Widow, probably better in the front office. I'm not 100% sure what she does.
No, she's pretty, she's got some pretty good lateral quickness. I think she'd be pretty good. Put her out wide. Give, just like Tyreek Hill, give her some space. Give her the ball in space.
Yeah. All right. I think we solved it. Yeah. I think that it'd be a version of an NFL thing that we'd never seen before. In Federer versus Dak Prescott in 2019, Dak actually had more earnings. Unless the new Federer non-Nike thing is bringing him in so much money, but he's also, you know, at the end of his career here a little bit. I'll go NFL. Because it'd be the most dominant player we've ever seen in team sports in the history of the United States, in the most popular sport in the United States.
And he just signed 2-year deals all the time, right? Or a year deal even. It's like, fuck it, a year deal. Who's got the most money? Because we could just take over your team no matter who you are. Everyone gets a Super Bowl.
Well, think about what Mahomes got. What, you know, $500 million. And that's
but that's for the 10 years. What if he's like, yeah, I want the same thing, but just a 2-year deal. That's it.
New TV deal?
He could probably do that. Yeah.
New TV deal, yeah. Yeah. All right. I think I think we're going to leave in NFL, even though I love the international.
I'll go party. NFL too.
Okay, that's life advice. Sort of. Thanks to Kyle and Steve. Check us out, Bill Simmons and I, on Sundays as we'll wrap up the regular season, get ready for the playoffs. We're back next Tuesday. Please subscribe, Ringer, Spotify.